Hello and welcome to the Private Capital Podcast. I'm Joe Riley, head of Circulus Group, which is a forum for the family office world. Scott Sperling is the co-CEO of Thomas H. Lee Partners. We had an excellent conversation about his time at Harvard Management Company under legendary figures like Walter Cabot and Jack Meyer, his thoughts on the evolution of private equity, the growth of THL, how the firm is structured, his top metrics, and how to find new areas of growth. Scott is co-CEO and co-chair of the firm's management committee. Prior to joining Thomas H. Lee Partners, Scott was, for more than a decade, managing partner of the affiliate of Harvard Management Company that managed all alternative asset classes for Harvard University's endowment fund. Before that, he was a senior consultant with the Boston Consulting Group. Scott has an MBA from Harvard Business School and a Bachelor of Science degree from Purdue University. Please enjoy my conversation with Scott Sperling.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said by the guests or host should not be construed as legal or investment advice. Thanks for listening.
I always love starting with someone's background. Where did you grow up and what did you study at Purdue?
So I mostly grew up in the Midwest. I was born in the Bronx, but then my family quickly, we had moved out when I was very young. So I mostly grew up in St. Louis and then ended up going to Purdue, which is a place that for some reason I can't actually identify. I always wanted to go to and ended up studying econometrics, mostly at Purdue. From there, I went directly to business school and I'd never had a white collar job until after I graduated from college. My summers were spent either working a construction job or as a stripper loader for Consolidated Freightways a couple of summers.
Wow, I haven't heard that name in a long time. My brother worked for CF.
So isn't that right?
Thing when he was in college. Yeah.
I was what they called a casual worker, which meant yes. I showed up for the graveyard shift. And I knew somebody who was in the union and they managed to put my name on the list most of the time. And as long as you worked as hard as you could ever work, they would call you back. And that's what I did. And I was making $9 an hour, but time and a half because I was working graveyard. And they often made us work overtime, which was double time. So it was, it was hog heaven for me at that point. And then went to HBS, worked over the summer for McKinsey in LA. I actually had no idea what consulting firms did. All I knew is I had a lot of student debt and they paid a reasonable amount of money. And so it seemed like a good job. My family, my father and siblings had moved to LA from St. Louis in the meantime. So being out there was a priority. And then ended up meeting my wife, who was a first year student when I was a second year student at HBS, and got married after I graduated at the end of her first year. So wanting to stay in Boston, McKinsey didn't have a Boston office. So I went to work for BCG and I was there, had great experience, almost was never home. There was one point in my career where I was commuting between Decatur, Illinois, Houston, Texas, and Jyväskylä, Finland. And so I would have to make an appointment to see my wife, who at that time, after graduation, became an investment banker at airports. And then your friend Walter Cabot hired me to go to Harvard Management Company, which was a very bold move. And as Walter was an incredible visionary, it was his idea to create Harvard Management. He had become deputy treasurer at Harvard, but had come out of the money management business. And at the time, he was looking for somebody who can move them into alternative investments, because it was a mostly domestic stock bond program, although much of it internally managed at the time. And he wanted somebody without a traditional investment management background. And somehow I ended up with the job. And over the course of 11 years, we grew it from nothing to about 22, 23% of the endowment. And that would be what we used to call leverage buyouts, as opposed to just private equity, venture capital. I had been given the real estate group and then what they called commodities, which was mostly oil and gas and some timber. And then in 1994, Tom Lee had lost his most senior partner, John Childs, was moving to start his own firm. I had done some investing, co-investing with Tom, and He asked me to join the firm, which I did. And then in 95, we raised our first large fund, the first billion-dollar fund. And I've been there ever since.
Did you ever consider any other career?
I'm not really a great planner in that regard, which I think is when people say, why are you so happy all the time? I guess I just didn't have much foresight. I can't say I had never heard of private equity when Walter and a headhunter for him approached me about it. And I had never heard of consulting when I took the consulting job out of business school. So ignorance was truly bliss and it worked out for me. I can't say that there was anything special that I would have otherwise done. I come about this business more from the consulting operating perspective than from the investment banker perspective, which kind of predominates a lot of firms. We have a very heavy percentage of our senior staff are consultants on the what we call our strategic resource group side and operators. And so I tend to favor more the operationally intensive sorts of things. So I guess the alternative would have been just to work for a company.
Harvard Management Company has had a very interesting history. You were there for some pivotal years. So yep. Love to spend a few minutes on it. You've already touched on this a bit, but I'm curious how Walter found talent back in 1984, because he made such dramatic changes. He took it wasn't necessarily a stodgy firm, but it was a lot of real estate and preferred stock and dividend paying stocks, and dramatically shifted it into options, stock lending, and obviously private investments.
Yeah.
So how did Walter find the folks for the firm back then?
I think Walter, while he came out of a traditional 65-35 stock bond mindset, and I think that's where much of the world was at the time, he had enormous curiosity and enormous confidence that he could help Harvard match its investing with the fact that it was a 350-year-old institution with at least another 350 years to go. So in thinking about the very nature of taking advantage of that very long-term perspective and that AAA type rating, I think he looked at areas that can generate better risk-adjusted returns where immediate liquidity wasn't necessarily required. And as we know, and we saw this in 87, but we saw it in 91. We most recently saw it in 2008. Sometimes the liquidity is illusory. In other words, you might think you have a liquid security in that publicly traded stock or that publicly traded fixed income security. But when things go south and you really need it, sometimes there is no liquidity. There's a reality that comes out of the depth of experience and granular understanding of how these things work that I think Walter had that allowed him to make these leaps that I think has been clearly very beneficial for Harvard. And once doing that, he was able to move Harvard, hire people who were then able to effectuate the movement into these areas. So whether it was our trading desk that, as you identified, we're looking at ways to drive much better risk-adjusted returns in tradable securities of various types and be very creative about creating derivatives where one could exploit gaps in the market, or moving into the alternative asset classes that have generated higher risk-adjusted returns. And if I look at private equity, particularly North American buyouts, that asset class has outperformed everything over the course of almost any period you look at, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. So you've seen that. So there is a real risk-adjusted return advantage there that I think Walter envisioned, even if he didn't actually understand in detail the nature of what became private equity. He was somebody who was a quick study and understood what that opportunity might be and went after people who might help realize that. And I think Harvard really is indebted to Walter in that regard. The other element of it is that he created an environment where I think people were able to work for a not-for-profit institution effect that for Harvard, but where the intellectual excitement about what we were doing compensated perhaps for the lower than market compensation that we were taking at the time.
And how did Walter decide on the allocation? Did it come all from the top, or was there a lot of feedback and input from across the firm?
Yeah, it was. The answer is yes. It was feeding into Walter and a fellow named Don Bean at the time, who did a lot of the, he was a guy who really helped build the trading capability that really attracted a lot of very smart people that were able to generate high returns for Harvard, utilizing Harvard's credit rating in ways that had dramatically higher return relative to risk characteristics.
I think HMC had something like 300 private investments in the 80s. I'm interested in how you did your sourcing, how you did your diligence. How different was that from today?
Like much of private equity in those days, we were more generalists. I built up a staff of people, hired a number of people who, like me, came out of consulting. And we had a set of relationships, expert relationships that came out of the Harvard network. And at the time, the Harvard Corporation, the fellows, was a much smaller group. They were individuals like Bob Stone and on the overseers, Bob Barker, who were longtime investors in venture capital, buyouts, real estate, other private asset classes, and oil and gas, and had a set of relationships that were very valuable to us. And then over time, we became an investor in a number of venture capital and a few buyout firms. And then we started to co-invest with them. So we were probably Kleiner Perkins' most frequent co-investor during that period. And we were able to leverage off of the relationships we had with Jeep, who had a very strong track record.
Did you have a specific target company in mind, or was it more opportunistic?
It was more opportunistic, where we would take advantage of the folks who were more technology-focused in venture capital, both IT and healthcare, as well as look at opportunities as they came up. And then we moved into areas when the asset allocation program decided that we needed to bring some other form of balance or counterbalance to the portfolio, hence the movement into commodities, which had tendency to be a countervailing force to the equity markets.
And how much competition was there in those days for those deals?
In those days, not a lot. That was a very different period than we see today. So that was a different world. The dollar sizes were dramatically lower. The work that we were doing, we were able to present to that small group of folks at the Harvard Corporation. I used to have a session with them every 6 months and review what we were doing. People wanted to make sure that taking these kinds of positions were appropriate for an endowment like Harvard. Harvard was clearly out front at that point in doing these sorts of things. And again, it helped that we had people who really understood the investing business or were themselves active investors in these areas on the Harvard Corporation board.
What were those meetings like?
Very smart group of individuals asking really good questions. Over time, a lot of head nodding. We were fortunate that much of what we did early on was very successful. The timing of when things are successful when you're starting a new program actually matters. And so again, we were able to grow that both through appreciation as well as enthusiastic investing, as I said, to over 20% of the endowment by the time I left.
And what was 87 like for our younger listeners at the firm?
Well, it's hard for people to understand for the younger listeners, because while the absolute numbers seem much smaller than movements we see today, the percentage drop was so dramatic, and everyone was looking back to the 28, 29, 30, looking at all the, what were the analogs for movements in the stock price. And you had that Friday, and then you had the Black Monday drop. Now, Harvard, as you might know, our traders were called to Congress because our trading desk had taken massive short positions for actually quite a while, well before that period. And so Harvard actually made money net on that day because of that. That was great for Harvard, and people wondered why and how did that impact things. And I think, I can't remember, but I think it was not Kidder Peabody. It was a level of computer-driven trading that hadn't existed before. Automated trading that really caused the dramatic drop in the indices over a very short period of time, over a matter of hours. And Harvard actually had some benefit from that.
Good old-fashioned portfolio insurance. We don't hear about that anymore, do we?
We do not. We do not.
So unfortunately, Walter had to step aside. What was the transition to Jack Meyer like?
Jack was just a bit of a different generation. And I would say that when Jack came in, we were preserving all the things that Walter had done to really build what it was the kind of an industry-leading capability, as we also put in place some of the things that Jack had seen. And there were new compensation systems that were put in place that over the course of time actually led to compensation levels that I think were quite competitive with the private sector. And Jack, it took him a little time, but he became a big fan. He was already a fan of alternatives, but also became a big fan of what some of our both fixed income and equity trading folks were doing. And actually, when he left, he went off with Dave Middleman and Maury Samuels, who had led those efforts and formed Convexity. But it was a form of trading that had been very profitable for Harvard.
And how would you contrast the styles of those two managers?
I think part of it is just generational. Walter was a great visionary who, they both had a personal style. They were just different people. And I think Walter's style relied on his very long experience and intuition in business. And he was, as I said, a very smart, forward-thinking individual who generally turned out to be right about the things that he had. And I would say Jack perhaps had a little bit more quantitative approach, analytically quantitative approach to things.
How did Meyer balance keeping talent versus it spinning out?
I think a lot of it was putting in place a compensation system that became much more competitive with the private sector than we had. The nature of the incentive system that we had for a few years, I guess I was Harvard's highest paid employee, which never failed to cause the crimson to be. But it was at a time when you wouldn't get anywhere close to what you can be paid in the private sector for equivalent work. And I think over time, the programs Jack brought in that regard brought them much closer.
And what are your thoughts on HMC's journey since you left? They've always been trying to strike a balance. And in fact, those two managers very much represented that shift into, we're going to get more into alternatives.
Yep.
But there's always, and I'm sure you work with a lot of endowments and big LPs, there's always that tension between in-house and outsourcing. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, they've really come, it's evolved pretty dramatically. When I was there, it was a lot of in-house married with relationships and investing in a set of GPs that really can help drive, co-invest and provide high returns on the private equity and venture capital side for Harvard. And I think Jack continued that, and it continued through a couple of other successors. But over the last number of years, it has changed so that I think the reliance is almost totally now on outside relationships.
Do you think there's a way to strike a balance?
I think so. I think we see this with a lot of our own LPs who are very strong strategic partners of ours that co-invest very actively alongside of the transactions that we create and manage. And so I see that every day in terms of LPs. Many of them are large sovereign wealth funds that continue to invest very heavily in recruiting and retaining really excellent people who have the capability to work, as we say, shoulder to shoulder with folks like us at THL. So I know that it is possible. There are a variety of ways to continue to drive strong returns, and what they're doing at Harvard right now, I think, has every possibility of doing that.
What's a day like for the co-CEO of THL?
Lots of meetings with deal teams, our LPs, particularly our large strategic partners who invest alongside of our deal teams in our companies. Every now and then doing things like this as part of the the public facing aspect of what we do. And then a lot of work with deal teams, thinking about portfolio companies and opportunities that we have, both to continue to accelerate revenue growth and improve the efficiency of our business models, which is an effort that is constantly underway at every company, where we bring a core of operating experts, we call our strategic resource group, together, actually starting in diligence with our domain experts, our investment professionals who live in that specific subsector. And what we're trying to do is look for opportunities to invest in companies where the industry or subsector has very strong secular growth drivers to them that we believe are sustainable, and usually in places where we can build a franchise, where we do multiple deals over many years in all different aspects of that subsector, and where we believe we can help that company get to that next higher level of performance. And that involves deploying our people, looking for ways to improve the key business processes of those companies. That is something that we have lots of people working on at every portfolio company, and where it's important for those of us in the as co-CEOs to continue to be on top of.
How do you divide the responsibilities with your talented colleagues on the leadership team?
So Todd Abrecht, who's been my co-CEO for a number of years, he succeeded Tony Genovi, who had been co-leading the firm with me since the early 2000s, late 1990s, is a very talented individual. We both come out of the investing side, and we work together more hand in hand on things. And the allocation is more based somewhat on interest and somewhat on background in terms of the nature of the deals that we may get a little bit closer to and what we do on the overall general management or administrative side. And Todd had been effectively the person who, over the course of much of the last decade, was responsible for putting in place and managing key processes that were really helpful to us as we grew. The firm has had enormous growth, where if you look back to where we were 17, 18 years ago, we were really a generalist firm with 11 or 12 partners and 34, 35 professionals. And today we're over 40 partners, over 160 professionals, very focused on being experts in three broad areas: in business solutions, healthcare, and financial technology and services. But it's really not the broad sectors. It's really subsectors that we identify within those that get approved by the investment committee to be what we call an identified sector of opportunity, or ISO. And each ISO has a full team assigned to it of professionals and operating experts and business development professionals, where we're trying to, again, really build and extend the franchise that we have in each. In the case of automation, which was one of our ISOs subsectors, that's grown.
And what do you think the opportunity is there? Why is that of so much interest?
It's both a very large market or set of markets, and it's probably a 20-year, if you look at the work McKinsey, BCG, Bain have done, they would tell you it's at least a 20-year, very rapid growth area. We started off by investing in companies that were helping e-commerce fulfillment. So we identified that as an area. Jim Carlisle, who heads up our automation fund and heads up our technology and business solutions vertical, had been early back in 2013 to 2015 looking for opportunities to help e-commerce companies do what they do better, particularly focusing on some of the physical fulfillment sorts of things. And we identified the opportunity to help build and automate the very large sortation facilities, these million square foot facilities that were the backbone of fulfillment by Amazon, UPS, FedEx, DHL, many others. And so we invested in a company that did that, and that grew into a number of other opportunities in that space. And we grew that company dramatically, 4 to 5x. And at the same time, established ourselves as a leader in this very important area. And so we brought in a lot of people as partners, as people, executive partners who really grew up in that space. So individual who was the head of automation for Amazon or Walmart, person who was the head of DARPA's optical systems and robotics efforts, people who had been CEOs of other automation companies like Dematic, all became involved with us. And because it was such a big opportunity, we worked with many of our large investors who were very interested in investing heavily in it, but where we didn't want to overweight our flagship fund, which by definition needs more diversity, which is that sector, we created our first automation fund.
In your 3 decades at the firm, are there any deals in particular that stand out?
Actually, quite a few. I look back at things I did, Fisher Scientific or Experian. Fisher, it's interesting. It was a similar theory to what we've done and what I described in e-commerce fulfillment. With Fisher, we knew that science was growing. We didn't think we were smart enough to pick all the biotech companies that would be winners. So we decided, let's buy the company that provides all sorts of stuff to all of those companies. And eventually that became Thermo Fisher. It was a great deal for us. We took it public, ended up selling our stock. I stayed on as an independent director, of which whatever it is, 20 some odd years later, I'm still the lead director of what is now Thermo Fisher Scientific, which has grown to over $200 billion company. Building an enterprise like that, being able to work with somebody like Mark Casper, who's probably the best CEO I've ever worked with, and before him, Ryan Deckers, and before him, Paul Montrone and Paul Meister, has been a great experience. Similarly, Experian, where we bought the TRW credit business, and in that case, it was taken from us pretty quickly. A deal where you make 3 times your money in 7 weeks, and it was the largest investment the firm had ever done. That was a good thing to do, along with our partners at Bain Capital, Warner Music, Houghton Mifflin, all great deals. But the firm has had enormous success across a wide range of companies in each of the verticals that we've talked about. Other pharma services companies like C-Safe, so many fintech companies like FIS, Black Knight, two of the largest companies now in the world in terms of providing outsourced technology services to large parts of the financial service landscape. Companies like Fortinet, MHS, AutoStore, which has been a huge home run for us, is a company that provides a robotic system for warehouses that allows you to utilize the cubic footage of a warehouse. It's an incredibly advanced system where you can create cubes of various sizes and where you can stack things now to take advantage of all of the space in a warehouse to dramatically reduce the needed footprint and do it in ways where you can pick up a car or you can pick up a pen and then resort it in ways that are incredibly efficient. Companies like Nextech in the healthcare IT space. So yeah, I can keep on going on, but it's been it's a great business for those of us who just enjoy operating businesses.
Well, I'm glad to see your Consolidated Freight experience helped you with the cube company.
Yes,
you
it is.
Knew it inside out. You knew it inside out.
I know what it's like to be the automator of a warehouse. I wanted to be one of those tow motor men who were driving around, but you right. Got to be in the for that.
Yeah, you got to get certified. Have your metrics to measure the success of your underlying companies changed over your years there? Are there things that you find more important now that you didn't focus on previously? Because obviously fixing operational businesses from the operational size changes.
You know, so it's a really good question. For each company, there is a defined set of metrics that go to the nature of the projects we've identified to improve key business processes. So there's, of course, all the normal financial metrics that we monitor very closely in with great granular detail. But then there are very specific things that we're looking at that we believe will impact that financial performance. And every company has its own set of those things. And our teams are charged with closely monitoring those elements. And we do a quarterly full portfolio review where the investment committee and the portfolio review committee can dig into the details of every company's performance. And if there is anything either exceptionally good or potentially bad that may go on in a portfolio company, that gets raised on a weekly basis with the investment committee. And so we're constantly trying to monitor not just the output in terms of financials, but to your point, really a series of inputs that we believe will drive those financial results.
And is there any in particular that you find helpful?
It's really very specific to these companies, but we're trying to measure the efficiency of go-to-market. So there are a number of different metrics that we look at, how efficient our sales force is and where the efficiency is higher. So we can constantly redeploy to places that have the highest yield and identify places where we're not being as successful as we think we are. We're always looking at companies that develop or produce product as opposed to service, the nature of all the inputs that may go into the COGS part, the cost of goods that we're measuring. And then we're trying to always look at the efficiency of how G&A is deployed for a company, looking for where there may be points to drive scale. And that could be an opportunity to grab incremental margin for the company.
How do you think about institutionalizing the process at Lee so that you can deliver the benefits that you've learned from one company to the next?
That's a really good question. What we have done is, if you start with the thought that we're building franchises in very identified and consistent subsectors, we are embedding both within our people, but then making sure it's institutionalized across the firm, knowledge about how those businesses work in very gory detail. And we're constantly adding to the list of what best practices could be, what may be portable to companies that are similar or may not be similar in terms of the nature of the sector, but where we can learn from some of the things that have worked. The fact that we have, as integral to how we operate, this large group, 21 right now, senior operating experts who work on deal teams hand in hand with our investment professionals on those deal teams, that organization that we call our strategic resource group, they're constantly monitoring and remonitoring and recording all of these sorts of things. So we have people who are experts in go-to-market within that group. That's what they do. That's what they live. And then within that go-to-market group, we have people who focus on pharma services or may focus on software companies, constantly learning what works, what doesn't work, and what we might try. When we owned a big CRO, Syneos, we had a large team of people who work with them and had relationships with all 20 of the 20 largest pharma companies out there. So when we looked at a company that was in a space that the macro resonated with us, this is a company called C-Safe. And this is a company that is one of the two companies in the world that have these boxes that are climate controlled to ship biologics. So we knew that biologics were growing. In fact, early on, they were growing exponentially in terms of the percent of drug delivery that was occurring. And they're very high value, so that you can have a box and that box can have $20 million worth of life-saving product in it. You cannot afford for that to be damaged by humidity or heat or cold. But when we looked at this company originally, we noticed that they only had one top 20 pharma relationship. And yet we had people who had been running go-to-market in the CRO space and had the relationships with big pharma. And so we deployed her into this company in order to build the relationships with the top 20 pharma. And within 2 years, we had contracts with 18 of the top 20 pharma companies and had enormous growth in the revenues and profitability of this company. We were able to take advantage of the fact that we identified an emerging subsector, it was something within pharma services that had great growth tailwinds that are going to last 20 plus years. And we identified a company that was well positioned, but didn't have the capabilities to take full advantage of what they had in a industry that was going to have dramatic growth. And so we were able to bring that to bear.
THL has always been interested in growth, but obviously growth changes over time from sector to sector. How do you folks filter the universe to find the type of growth that you want?
We're constantly looking at where we think the trends are, more macro trends within the sectors, the broad sectors that we invest in. And we'll make changes over time if we have to. We have a good heritage in the consumer sector, but back in the middle of the last decade, we dropped our consumer vertical because we just didn't think that the secular drivers were there to sustain the kind of growth that we're seeing in the other three verticals we had. And so we'd rather redeploy that resource into the faster growing verticals. And then within those verticals, we're constantly reevaluating the ISOs or the subsectors that we're in, and we'll occasionally add a new one. So in healthcare, for example, bioprocessing is our newest ISO. Now that used to be part of pharma services, but the very nature of serving the large molecule biologic side of the world is actually quite different than what with the more traditional pharma services. And so we split that off. Automation used to be e-commerce enabling. And then we broke that into a couple of different ISOs where automation, again, became so large that it's both an ISO and a separate effort. So we're constantly looking at where we think strong secular driven growth is, and then trying to bring in the expertise and build even more expertise and bring in relationships that will help us build a real franchise in each of those areas.
So as lending rates have changed, how do you think about the appropriate amount of leverage to put on these companies based on revenue?
The lending rates have two impacts. One is the coverage ratios, which you're really getting at with the amount of debt that we put on. Because we're buying and creating growth companies, we traditionally have not used all the leverage that would be available to us. We're really driving our returns more through EBITDA growth. So we haven't had to do that. But clearly, we're also very mindful of the cost of that debt and what it means for the cash flow coverage. So we make adjustments to make sure that we have a robust capital structure and whatever that means for the amount of debt to EBITDA, it will depend on that particular situation. One of the things that you have to do when rates go up is adjust your entry multiples. And that's particularly true because I believe that there, for a lot of reasons, that we're not going to go back to free money, that it's more likely that the 10-year stays in a kind of 3 to 5% range with periods where it might spike up. That's more likely than it coming back down below that 3% number. And therefore, exit multiples are not going to be as robust as what we've seen. One needs to take that into account as you think about the valuation, what you're paying for these companies. Last year was a very active year in looking at companies, as active as ever. But we only bought two companies because the pricing that people wanted was not, in our view, appropriate or what I've just described. And it was a frustrating year in that regard. We've been fortunate that our last couple of mature funds, our 2016 and 2019 fund, have both returned over 100% of all the invested capital. And so it gave us a little bit of flexibility in terms of not as much having to focus on selling, although we did sell a company last year, Nextech, a great company in the healthcare IT space. But it gave us the ability to focus more on just thinking about the world as a buyer. I think we're in a world where a lot of people put a lot of money to work reasonably quickly and haven't returned any dollars. And now they want to raise another fund. And so there's pressure to sell. That selling pressure, I believe, will bring selling price expectations or willingness to transact down in price in a way that will match more of what we're looking for in price. And so I would anticipate this year being a more fruitful year in doing that. We've always taken a very proactive approach in sourcing and have built a sourcing engine, as we call it, that consists of very senior people doing business development work. They often come out of our ISOs. They were C-suite executives, great Rolodexes. We make lots of introductions. The fact that we have lived in that business for a long time means we know a lot of people. And so what we're trying to do is create lots of meetings and then hopefully have more meetings with companies that are not even for sale, but have them get to know us. We get to know them. And then when they want to do something, we want to be the first call. We'd like to be the only call, but we know that sometimes you're not the only call. But one of the companies we bought, the most recent acquisition, is a company called Standish that provides, on an outsourced basis, you may be familiar with it, a lot of the services that GPs require in working with LPs, both in venture capital and private equity. It's been growing revenues at 35% CAGR, growing EBITDA even faster than that. Our team first met the management 3 years ago. I think they had 15 or 16 meetings with them. It wasn't for sale. But when it finally became for sale, we became the chosen partner of a management team that rolled $500 million into the deal alongside of us. And so we're looking for those kinds of opportunities. And it is often the case that we have to wait 1, 2, 3 years before the work we're doing to identify a company we'd like to buy actually materializes in an acquisition.
I'm glad you mentioned DPI. Obviously, a lot of LPs are focused on that, and you've been fortunate in that regard. But has it changed the way you think about exit strategies?
I mentioned earlier that one thing that characterizes us that may be different than most firms is that we do bring this operating resource, our strategic resource group, together with the investment professionals, the domain experts. We actually start in sourcing because we're trying to sell what we can do to these companies. What we did with so many situations is if a management team's interested in getting some resource that can help them get to the next level of performance, if there's a seller who wants to stay in the company and get a second bite at the apple, so take a lot of money out, but also make even more money the second time, then we're a good partner. That's a good dynamic for us. But because we are investing in areas that we really know well, we already have a theory as to how to make that company better in terms of accelerating revenue growth and improving the efficiency of the business model to drive higher levels of cash flow and profitability. We confirm all of that during diligence. And so by the time we sign a deal, we're ready to go in implementing all of the changes and all of the projects that we'd like to implement. And by the time we actually close the deal, much of that organizationally is underway. And what we have found is systemically, we can get to higher DPI faster because of the nature of our integrated process early on. And so we continue to invest in both sides of that and try to stay disciplined and actually have stayed disciplined in terms of only investing in those areas that we really know, where we have a franchise, where we have a lot of people who came out of those industries who can help us both evaluate the opportunity and be very realistic about what the upsides as well as the risks are, but also help us more quickly implement what we and others call the value creation plan for that company.
How does a PE firm think about going public or not? What are those discussions like?
I think a large part of it is what's in the interest of the partners. What are they, is that something that, like us, most of our partners would rather not do? Or in many cases, there's relatively tightly held ownership of the entity so that the benefit is very large for a small number of people and over time will get potentially larger for others. It's something that I think requires somewhat of a change in what you're going to be doing and how you're going to be doing business, and the fact that you're focused more on asset accumulation, given that the fee stream is the real key metric on how you get valued in the public markets. I think having a more diverse set of asset classes than a pure private equity firm has is important. I think if you talk to Mark Rowan at Apollo, he'll say, we're not really a private equity firm. We have great private equity, but the largest part of what they do is more related to credit, insurance, and that sort of thing. And I think if you look at Blackstone, real estate and credit are bigger or as big, if not bigger, than what we would call traditional private equity. And so you're really moving into areas that are different than if you want to continue to double down on the pure private equity side. It's neither better nor worse, but it is just different.
It's very different. They're turning into asset management firms, essentially. Yeah. A platform.
Yes.
And you folks have never considered that.
It's not something that has been what we want to do. I think most of our partners, and I know for myself, again, we like being owner quasi operators of businesses. That's what we really enjoy doing. And I think that's different than being a very large AUM driven firm.
Scott, how do you relax after all the travel that you do?
Grandchildren.
Oh, good. How many?
7.5.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yep. They are the best. They are the best.
But any hobbies, anything?
For 20 some odd years, I played rugby. And then over the course of 2 years, two ruptured bicep tendons took me out of that. And now my wife and I will watch our kids playing tennis, which we were both big tennis players. And then particularly my wife, much better than me. And then participate in whenever they let us, which is rare, and things like pickleball. And then we're both involved in other not-for-profit opportunities. My wife chairs the board of Duke at CJP in Boston, and I chair the board of the Mass General Brigham Healthcare System. We try to contribute back in meaningful ways.
What are those discussions like, Mass General? What's it like to be on the other side of the table?
Number one, I would say that, and this starts with when I first got involved in the Brigham board 20 some odd years ago, really awe what they do as the largest and probably the best high-end clinical provider in the country, in the world, amongst the two academic medical centers. It's one of the only systems that actually has two very large AMCs and three top-ranked specialty hospitals in McLean and Spalding and Mass Eye and Ear, and a bunch of great community hospitals. What they do on the clinical side is awe-inspiring. We're the largest research system by far in the world. And so the work that they do has really global implications in terms of the generation of new life science and the translational nature of applying that to patients. We're the largest teaching, we're the Harvard affiliated hospitals that are the largest teaching organization. And then we commit an enormous amount to the community. The problem with all of that is that nobody really wants to pay for most of those things. Every year we start $2 billion in the hole. There's about $1.5 billion of not fully reimbursed clinical care that we provide to the communities and people in need. There's $500 million of unreimbursed indirect expenses in research and the cost of teaching that next generation of physicians and leaders of the medical community in the United States and globally. And so nobody really wants to pay for those things. It's not a business model that you'd want to invest in. But I think for those of us who are very involved in it, I think we would all say that it's probably the most meaningful thing that we can contribute back, given the importance to our communities and the importance to life science globally that we can do. But the people who run it, Anna Klebanski, who's our CEO, is just an extraordinary individual, one of the great physician scientists of the world who, when thrust into that job as CEO, and I first became chairman and former CEO had retired, has just done an extraordinary job through COVID. And we've built an enormous capability underneath her that we hadn't had historically. And by necessity, we have taken what was a disparate set of hospitals, again, best in the world, but they were all in that Harvard tradition, tubs on their own bottom. And we've now brought them together as a system so that we can dramatically increase the amount of capacity that we have to take in patients so they don't have to wait 4 months, 9 months, 10 months in order to get an appointment with a world-leading specialist, or they don't have to wait 9 weeks to get that MRI. We've now been able to take advantage of the totality of the resource and system to significantly improve that and look at ways of providing that kind of very high-end tertiary and quaternary care at the lowest total medical expense that we can.
Scott Sperling, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insights with us today.
You are very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with your friends. Thank you.